There's a statistic that we need to consider. It's that one out of every one dies. On the other hand, Jesus of Nazareth made amazing personal claims, and he gave his followers a very significant promise. He said, "I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die." If these words from Jesus are true, then there's a way that we can beat the one out of every one statistic. But the validity of his claims and promises rest on his fulfillment of the assertion, "Because I live, you will live also." If Jesus did rise from the grave, as the Bible claims, then we can count on those promises. It's imperative that you give serious consideration to the question, "Did Jesus Christ really rise from the grave?" The importance of this question is also emphasized by the Apostle Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians, where he wrote, "If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith." Put another way, if Jesus Christ did not rise from the grave, then the Christian faith is a waste of time, a bad joke. But if Jesus Christ did actually rise from the grave, then his personal claims are validated, and there are eternal implications for each of us. Implications so vital that it would be utterly foolish to ignore this question. Another question logically follows. Is there any solid evidence that Jesus did rise from the grave on that first Easter Sunday morning? I believe the answer to this question is a resounding yes. But before we look at the evidence, I want to respond to what I believe is the primary reason that many people do not believe that Jesus actually rose bodily from the grave. It's the assumption that a bodily resurrection of someone who has been dead for 3 days is just too improbable to believe. Based on common knowledge, it's reasonable to assume that when someone actually dies, they stay dead. If the only thing we considered was probability, we should not even have life in the first place, let alone have the ability to analyze questions about life and death. The Bible teaches us that God had a purpose when he put us on planet Earth, and I believe that there's a divine purpose behind your listening to this CD. It's even more important that we consider the person behind the purpose. The Bible's claim is that God, who created the universe and gave us the improbable life that we now possess, did it again when he gave new life to the body of Jesus Christ after he was crucified and placed in that tomb. In 1833, Simon Greenleaf was appointed the Royal Professor of Law at Harvard University. At Harvard, he was one of the founders of the Harvard Law School, and he wrote a treatise on the laws of legal evidence that is considered a classic of American jurisprudence. While a professor in the Harvard Law School, Greenleaf was challenged to evaluate the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but concluded that the evidence that Jesus rose from the grave is more than sufficient to establish it in a court of law. My approach to the question, what happened on that first Easter Sunday morning, is not as technical as that taken by Greenleaf. I merely summarize what I have learned by studying the research of many others. We start with a look at one of the most influential men of history, the Apostle Paul. Paraphrasing part of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul wrote, "We know that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. We know because after he was crucified and put in a tomb, over 500 people saw him alive at one time, and many of those people are yet alive with us to this day." This passage and others from Paul's letters that became part of the New Testament, and the historical records about Paul found in the book of Acts, clearly reveal the following. First, the Apostle Paul was a very intelligent man and a brilliant debater, one of the great advocates of history. Second, the Apostle Paul was very controversial. He had many critics who would do anything they could to discredit him. Some even plotted to kill him. Third, the Apostle Paul was not writing with us in mind, who lived nearly 2,000 years after his death. Rather, he was first and foremost writing to the people of his day. Fourth, the writing of the Apostle Paul clearly established two important things to consider. First, what Paul believed, and second, some things the people Paul was writing to believed. Paul's statements clearly tell us that he believed that Jesus had risen from the grave 3 days after he was placed in that tomb. But it's even more important that we ask, what did the people Paul was writing to believe? If they didn't believe that 500 people saw Jesus alive after his crucifixion, and that many of those 500 were still alive when Paul wrote, then his assertion was very foolish, as it would have effectively destroyed his credibility. His critics would have used it to ridicule him. Paul's letters would have been so discredited that it is unlikely we would know anything of him today. It's absurd to think that a brilliant advocate like the Apostle Paul would have made the claim that 500 people saw Jesus alive after he was crucified, and that many of those who witnessed his post-resurrection appearances were still living in the midst of those he was writing to, if he did not believe it was true. Paul was not the only one who wrote based on this belief. The other writers of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Peter, James, Jude, and whoever wrote the book of Hebrews, all wrote from the belief that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. He was killed by crucifixion, but 3 days later he arose from the grave. In their writings, they also assumed that the people they were writing to believed these same things. Where did this widespread belief come from? Remember, most of these people were contemporaries of Jesus. There had been no time for a legend to develop. Furthermore, they held to this belief in spite of the fact that it cost many of them dearly. They were literally thrown to the lions. We know they held steadfastly to this belief because if they had not believed that Jesus Christ rose from the grave, the church, a product of that belief, would not even exist today. No one can seriously question whether Jesus lived. To suggest that the historical records about his life were merely fiction is beyond being incredulous. These authors were not prolific writers who made their living from selling novels. One was a medical doctor, another a tax collector, and two were fishermen. It would be impossible for these men to have created a fictitious character and then to convince over 500 people into thinking they saw him alive after the Romans publicly crucified him, and after he spent 3 days in the tomb, and then that these same people were willing to die for the improbable fictitious concoction. After evaluating the testimony of four eyewitnesses, Simon Greenleaf concluded, and I quote, "Either the men of Galilee were men of superlative wisdom and extensive knowledge and experience and of deeper skill in the arts of deception than any and all others before or after them, or they have truly stated the astonishing things which they saw and heard." Close quote. To deny he lived would make a mockery of historical inquiry. No reputable historian questions that he was an actual living person. Having to admit that Jesus Christ lived, but starting with the assumption that what we call miracles are impossible, some would describe this as blind prejudice, many scholarly skeptics have tried to examine the historical records about Jesus and to reconstruct them without the supernatural elements. Early in the 20th century, there were many respected scholars involved in this effort. These scholars tried to describe Jesus as a simple teacher of righteousness who did not perform the miracles recorded in the Gospels. They assumed that the miracles were fictitious embellishments added to the records about the real Jesus, and that the ultimate embellishment was the story of his resurrection. But the efforts to find a different Jesus from the gospel accounts proved to be an impossible absurdity. In account after account, the removal of the miracle destroyed the very purpose for which it was written. Furthermore, their efforts to remove the miracles created a major problem. They couldn't deny that the simple teacher of righteousness that they postulated believed he was the Messiah who was promised in the prophecies of the Old Testament. It's nearly as easy to establish that Jesus claimed he was the promised Messiah as that he lived it all. That's why they had him crucified. If Jesus was merely a dynamic leader and teacher, but not who he personally claimed to be, the logical conclusion is that he was either a hypocritical liar or a delusional schizophrenic. As Oxford scholar C.S. Lewis correctly observed, either Jesus was who he claimed to be, the Son of God, or he was a liar or a lunatic. Jesus left us no other alternative. Close quote. So we know there once lived a man named Jesus who claimed he was the Messiah and whom most historians recognize as one of the world's all-time greatest leaders and teachers. We also know that the only records about him attribute to him the power to perform great signs and wonders, and most amazing of all, many of his contemporaries believed that he rose from the dead 3 days after he was crucified and laid to rest. Some skeptics just bury their heads in the sand and ignore this evidence. But if someone wants to honestly maintain their skeptical unbelief, it's imperative that they answer the question, what happened? Where did this belief come from? Through the centuries, skeptics have come up with several theories that try to take into consideration the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but try to explain how his contemporaries could have believed it, even if it did not actually happen. There have been several versions, but just three main theories. Let's take a look at them. Theory number one is that Jesus did not really die. This is sometimes called the swoon theory. It suggests that after spending a day hanging on a cross and having a spear thrust in his side, that Jesus did not really die. He merely went into a coma, was wrapped in linen and ointment, and laid in a tomb. But after 3 days in the tomb, without food or water, he was resuscitated, busted out of the linen and ointment that bound him, pushed back the gigantic boulder that sealed the entrance to the tomb, and walked by the sleeping guards, who according to Roman law would be executed if they went to sleep on the job. In his weakened state, he then appeared to his disciples and about 500 other people before he disappeared, never to be seen or heard from again. This theory has few advocates. It's not reasonable that anyone would believe that someone in such a weakened condition was the risen Son of God. Theory number two is called the visionary hypothesis. This theory suggested that he did die, but that he did not rise from the tomb. The response of his disciples and the 500 witnesses is explained by asserting that they did not really see Jesus after he was crucified. They just thought they saw him. They had visions. His appearances were like mirages. Now, we might accept one or two visions, but over 500 people all having the same vision is hard to believe, even if there was something that would psychologically encourage them to have the visions. If Jesus had healed the sick, given sight to the blind, hearing to the deaf, and made the lame to walk, we could understand why some people might have had visions. But if he did those things, it's not hard to believe that he rose from the grave. Those miracles would substantiate his claim that he is the Messiah, even the Son of God. And thus it would be reasonable to believe that he rose victoriously. But even if the advocates of the visionary hypothesis could overcome the problem of the improbability of 500 people having the same vision at the same time, they have no explanation for the empty tomb. The fact that Jesus claimed he was the promised Messiah and the irrefutable evidence that the actions of his followers tell us that they believed he was resurrected. This leads us to the only tenable theory. Theory number three is the stolen body theory. Recognizing that his tomb was empty, this theory asserts that someone stole the body of Jesus. But we must ask, why would someone steal a corpse? Sure, the Jews had a good motive. They could have used the body to quickly squash this new sect that so irritated them. But they could not produce his body to discredit the disciples' claim that he was their Messiah and had risen from the grave. How about a group of Romans? Maybe they stole his body. But why would they steal the body? What was its value? Sure, they could have sold it to the Jews, but as we have just observed, the Jews never produced the body. Furthermore, it was in the best interest of the Romans to maintain law and order. Pontius Pilate, the governor appointed by the Romans, was a political animal. He had to report to Caesar, and Caesar did not look kindly on turmoil or insurrections in his provinces. A missing body controversy would not sit well in Rome. That's why Pontius Pilate had Roman guards posted at the tomb of this one who claimed to be the King of the Jews. The most common assumption for this theory is that the disciples stole the body of Jesus. The problem with this proposition is that the disciples would have known that the faith they were promoting was fraudulent. Remember, 11 of the 12 disciples and many of his other followers gave their lives for the belief that Jesus rose from the grave and that he was the Messiah, the Son of God. The records indicate that the disciples disassociated themselves from Jesus when he was on trial. That was normal, natural behavior. Peter's denial of Jesus three times, one in response to a young girl, was what we would expect of a man who is running scared. But a few days later, this same Peter boldly risked being stoned by standing on the corner in Jerusalem, pointing his finger at the Jews and accusing them of killing their Messiah. What a reversal! Peter's transformation was unreal apart from having seen the risen Christ. Thomas, who first doubted and said that he would not believe in the resurrection of Jesus unless he could put his finger in Jesus' nail-pierced hands, was real and human. But Thomas, who went all the way to India as a missionary and died as a martyr, can only be explained because he later became convinced that Jesus rose from the grave and was the Messiah. The Bible explains he changed his mind because he personally met his risen Lord and Savior. Furthermore, we have to ask, why would his followers think that anyone would fall for the story that Jesus is the Messiah? Again, if Jesus actually healed the sick, gave sight to the blind, hearing to the deaf, made the lame to walk, stilled a storm, and walked on water, we can understand why they might think that people would be fooled into thinking that Jesus was the Messiah. But those things would clearly establish that his claims were true, that Jesus was and is the Messiah, the Son of God, and thus it would be reasonable to expect that the tomb could not hold him. Think about it, and you will realize how ridiculous it is to believe that such a fraudulent claim would be believed. One would have to assume that something unbelievable happened at a gathering of his followers a few days after Jesus was crucified. At this hypothetical gathering, someone would say, "You know, the teachings of Jesus were really good. We need to do something so people will follow them." At that, Peter jumped to his feet and said, "I have a plan. You gals go down to that tomb, flirt with the guards, slip a Mickey in their coffee. Then you guys can run down there, and when they're asleep, you can steal his body. Then I will risk my neck. I will go out, stand on the corner, and tell everyone that they crucified their Messiah and that he rose from the grave. But gang, we need to hang together on this because those people who had him crucified will be livid when I accuse them of killing their Messiah." Just remember, Jesus' teachings were so good that we need to be willing to die defending this big lie. It's the only way we can get people to follow his moral teachings. What an absurdity! None of these alternative theories makes any sense when one honestly considers the known facts. The most reasonable explanation for the historical evidence is that Jesus really was and is the promised Messiah, even the Son of God, and that he did rise from that grave. Furthermore, his resurrection was and is the ultimate verification that his personal claims and promises are true. But there is another body of evidence that Jesus rose from the grave that's even easier for us to examine today. The Bible not only tells us that Jesus rose from the grave, but Luke chapter 24 also tells us that after he arose, he walked and talked with some men on the road to Emmaus, a small town near Jerusalem. At first, these men did not recognize Jesus when he walked up alongside of them. They were troubled about the things that had happened in Jerusalem, about Jesus being crucified. Finally, Jesus responded to them by saying, "O foolish men and slow of hearts to believe all that the prophets have spoken, was it not necessary for the Christ, a word that means Messiah, to suffer these things and to enter into his glory?" The author Luke then continued on, "And beginning with Moses and all of the prophets, he explained to them in all of the scriptures the things concerning himself." In a nutshell, this record tells us that Jesus claimed that the Bible's Old Testament, a book written by about 40 men over a span of about 1,000 years and completed at least 400 years before he was born, talks specifically about himself when it foretold of a coming Messiah. Some of these Old Testament prophecies were written over 1,000 years before Jesus was born. Furthermore, it was the Jews that preserved these documents through the ages. It would be absurd to think that they altered them to defend the Christian faith. So today, we can easily check out the claims by Jesus on the road to Emmaus by examining the content of these Old Testament scriptures. I do not claim that I can reproduce that message for you, but after many years of studying and teaching from the Old Testament of the Bible, I have found many passages that he could have used in his message to them. To give you just an inkling of what he might have said, I have developed another audio CD titled Understanding Bible Prophecy. It's a summary of my book, The Master Plot of the Bible. If you still have doubts, I challenge you to get that CD and to consider the rock-solid evidence from the Old Testament that through supernatural prophecies, God has left his indelible fingerprints in the Bible, and they clearly establish that Jesus of Nazareth was and is the promised Messiah.